Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has now signed these treaties to annex parts of Ukraine occupied by the Russian forces. The signing came 3 days after the referendum on joining Russia that Ukraine and the West say are shams.
NATO's chief says this decision is the most serious escalation since the war began. Back with us now is Ruslan, who was originally from Donetsk, which is one of the regions that was annexed today. He's now in western Ukraine. Thanks for coming back with us, and glad you're still well and safe. Tell us your thoughts on this latest action by Vladimir Putin to, based on this really illegitimate, in the view of most of the world, illegitimate referendum, to declare these regions, including where you're originally from, right, now part of Russia.
There's really a lot of historical evidence to repeated attempts by Russia to create sort of a cultural and ethnical buffer zone between what they consider to be the imperialistic West and then the proud nation of Mother Russia. Since the founding of the region as a industrial and trading powerhouse back in 18th century, and actually even earlier than that, there was already a significant amount of settlements and mining industry and trade due to the access to the Mediterranean Sea through the Black Sea, through the Sea of Azov, mainly through the port of Mariupol. Russia has consistently tried to make sure that no Ukrainian culture really takes root in that region. And unfortunately, the havoc that the 20th century had wrought on Ukraine and the Holodomor genocide of 1930s, it took a very heavy toll on the region. There are two factors that need to be taken into consideration. The first one is that Russia, once they entered the 20th century, they still had peasantry as a socio-economic and cultural phenomena, even though the Western world by that time had already realized that, well, the freedom to choose where to work and in what type of labor to engage is actually conducive to growth and development. But in Russia, it wasn't like that. And so by the time that the Russian Empire collapsed during and due to World War I, a large number of poor Russian people moved into the Donbas region that was predominantly occupied by that time by Ukrainians that were much wealthier than those Russians that were moving in. And so that created a great opportunity for Russia later down the line, whilst conducting genocide of Ukrainian population, to also establish a cultural foothold with Russian citizens already being there. And then the terror of the 50s and the 60s following World War II only further exacerbated the problems. And there are statements of Ukrainians that were moving in back into Donetsk, and they were uncovering just heinous crimes following the so-called liberation of the region by the Red Army.
Yeah, so they have a history of doing this. It's in the playbook. They've tried it other places, and now we're seeing it again. And obviously, it's been called an escalation for all the reasons that we've covered here before. Do you still have people there, family members, friends that had to go through this? They get the knock at the door and they're like, hey, sign here and this is your vote. You don't have a choice.
Yeah, unfortunately, I did get a couple messages from my friends that still reside in Donetsk, and they hold no sympathy towards Russia. They just have such a life circumstances that they can't leave the city for various reasons, but mostly it has to do with, you know, family and everything. And I've also seen plethora of videos online from friends of friends, from, you know, social circles, social media, just literally people coming into your apartment with a gun and pretty much making you place your vote. And obviously that vote is, well, has only one outcome.
Do you worry that this, as many people in the U.S. worry now, that this is going to greatly escalate not only the tension, but the potential for a much more severe and wider conflict, because Putin, of course, is now, and he's already said that, that any attack in these regions like Donetsk is going to be, in his view, an attack on Russian soil, which would, in his mind, justify the use of more severe, up to and including, he's hinted several times, tactical nuclear weapons. Do you think that's all a bluff, or do you think that there's a serious potential for that occurring?
I'm someone who's quite interested in gambling as a phenomena. And there is a strategy in gambling called Martingale strategy. The basic premise of the strategy is that every time you make a bet and you lose, you need to double your next bet. And in theory, provided that you have unlimited time and unlimited capital, you eventually should recoup your losses and win. However, in reality, if you apply that principle to your actions, a streak of losses in that strategy will eventually bankrupt you. And far as I can tell, based on what I've been observing since 2014, what Russia has been doing, they've been almost maniacally following the strategy. And even when they were losing, they were escalating the bets even further. So I don't think personally that they will go as far as to actually authorize a nuclear strike, be that a strategic one or a tactical one, because the application of nuclear weapons is going to create just a devastating response for Russia from all the other countries, including those, well, pseudo-allied countries such as China or India or African countries at that. And so I just think it's a big, big, big Fed bluff. And on top of that, they also need to create the right picture for the society in Russia, because a lot of internal Russian problems are being resolved through that external conflict at the moment.
Ruslan there from Western Ukraine, originally from the Donetsk region. Ruslan, thanks for talking to us again.
Ukraine has responded to Russia annexing those occupied regions of Ukraine by submitting an accelerated application to join NATO. The U.S. responded too.
Yeah, and America slapping sanctions on more than 1,000 people and companies in Russia. U.S. also says it would support any efforts by Ukraine to take the occupied territories back by force, and says we're not going to recognize the annexation. Dan Hamilton, non-resident senior fellow with the Brookings Institution Center on the U.S. and Europe, also former State Department official. Dan, thanks for being with us. So we left the last segment with the talk about whether Putin and this nuclear positioning, tactical or not, defend the territory by any means, were his words. Whether that's a bluff or not, where do you come down on that?
Well, he's these are actions of a desperate, man who's trying to gain as much as he can now before winter sets in to sort of bluff the West, if possible, seize control of as much Ukrainian territory as he can, and then try to reinforce that with troops, even though his troops aren't even in control of the territories he annexed. It's very difficult to see. He has a lot of escalatory options besides nuclear weapons that he could use. And so we'll see. He is a desperate man, and history tells us he usually chooses escalation over de-escalation when he's in a corner.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you should say that, because in our last segment, we were talking to somebody in Ukraine who is from the Donetsk region, and he was saying, from his just knowledge of the history of his own country and its relationship with Russia, that whenever things were not going well for Russia, they would sort of, as a gambling gambit, if you will, they would double down, double the stakes, but it doesn't really lead to anything. Do you sort of concur with that analysis?
Well, I think Putin has shown that over the course of his rule, that whenever he seems to be a bit in trouble at home, he turns to repression abroad or adventurism. He's done that repeatedly, not only now, but he did it in 2014 when he first invaded Ukraine and annexed the Crimean Peninsula. He did it in Georgia in 2008. He has, of course, sent troops to Syria. He's been engaged with mercenary forces all through Africa. And other places, he's threatened most of his neighbors. And I think that is sometimes to rile up, you know, support within his country. What's changed now is that the nationalists to his right, I mean, even more, you know, rabid than he is, are accusing him of mismanaging the war, caving in. And so he's facing a new front at home besides the hundreds of thousands of people are headed for the borders when he's called up this partial mobilization. So he's facing considerable pressure at home.
Somebody brought that up yesterday, I think, when we were saying, well, is there someone who could just, you know, move Putin to the side if things continue to go badly? And I think most of our thought processes go to, yeah, that's great. Get rid of the guy and then stop the war. But you mentioned this other faction. I mean, what if someone takes over who wants to go even more full force in there?
Yeah, the likely candidates, unfortunately, at the moment are those who would be even more rabid, including his spy chief and a number of others around him, part of his inner circle, who are chomping at the bit and you know, not trying to urge caution on him, but to go the other way. And those are the ones in power and have the levers of power. So you don't see the opposition being, you know, in any real scenario that I see, suddenly coming to power. Alex Navalny, main opposition leaders in jail, as are some others. There aren't, you know, you see protests, but really Russian people are fleeing, or they're not raising their heads because they fear the consequences. So you just don't see that other opposition rising across the Russian society.
You know, that sort of begs an interesting question, doesn't it? I mean, he's not going to last forever, Putin. What does happen when he, I don't know, I guess he's not going to retire, but is too ill to do anything or dies?
Yeah, I think the core issue here is he does not want to go down in history, in his mind, as the ruler who, quote, lost Ukraine. Everything he says about it, you know, not a real country, part of Russia, but, you know, time immemorial, it's core to the Russian founding myths and all of that. He's not going to do that. So he's not going to reconcile to the loss of Ukraine. So when people, you know, commentators say, well, how will this end? I think two other questions are more relevant. One is, how will this actually continue? Even if there's a ceasefire, Russia will not reconcile, nor will Ukrainians, frankly, reconcile to what is now, you know, a line of control cutting across their territory. And the second question will be, how far will this extend? Because the turbulence and the disruption that's going on is not just on the land borders of Ukraine. It's extended throughout the Black Sea. Putin has weaponized, you know, people, energy, you name it, cyber. All the flows that connect societies are showing they can be disrupted, and he's doing that. The latest incident in the Baltic Sea, where there's sabotage in the pipelines, show how susceptible Western societies are to this type of disruptive, intentional disruptive influence. And Putin's shown that he is willing to escalate in those areas as well. So we're facing a multi-front war here that's starting to include, you know, many other countries beyond Ukraine.
Dan Hamilton there, non-resident senior fellow, Brookings Institution's Center on the U.S. and Europe, also former State Department official.